So, I think we're going to start. I know there's still some more people who are going to come, but they'll just have to trickle in. So, welcome, a very warm welcome to this event that's hosted by the Center for the Study of Human Rights. I'm Jenny Cooper. I've been a research fellow at LSE for quite a long time, and with the Center for the last few years. So, housekeeping things. Please turn phones to silent. There will be an audio recording of this event and possibly podcast in a while, in a few days, online. And also, you're welcome to comment on this using Twitter, which is going to be, the address is LSEMIChild. So do please bear that in mind. I don't think it's up there on the... Okay, good. Yeah. So the format is, I'll just briefly introduce, and then Catherine will start out speaking for maybe 15 minutes or so, then hand over to Baljeet, and then back to Catherine. We're aiming to end by about 7:30. And there'll be a reception after the event, so please do stay for that. Very short introduction before formally welcoming our two speakers. This event is going to focus on unaccompanied migrant children, mostly, particularly coming to the UK. It's a very difficult issue, it's very topical. Last year, apparently, there was something like 2,500 or more asylum applications from unaccompanied children in the UK, which is something like twice as many as in previous years, as I understand it. And the UK government has said it will take more children from Syria and other conflict-affected areas, but it hasn't actually said how many, as far as I know. So it's a very, very live issue at the moment. That's particularly why we're delighted to welcome these two lawyers who are absolutely at the forefront of work involving unaccompanied migrant children in the UK, and that's Catherine Cronin and Baljeet Sandhu. Before I formally introduce them, I want to say I had the great pleasure of working with both of them in the last couple of years. We were planning to do a project on the impact of legal aid cuts on young unaccompanied children coming to the UK. And in the course of that work, we actually involved a number of LSE students doing research for immigration lawyers. And that was a really unique experience for the young people. And also, I hope, useful for the lawyers. Good, because the legal aid cuts actually meant that their capacity to do this kind of research themselves has been cut. And I also have seen Catherine in action in the Supreme Court and in an Immigration Appeals Tribunal case which concerned a very vulnerable young trafficked woman and a very unsympathetic judge. And I had a close-up look of how skilled the legal work has to be in these cases, as well as all the human skills that are involved in dealing with this kind of case. And I was very happy to hear from Catherine just now that it seems that maybe that case is having a good outcome, which looked very unlikely at the time. So, Now, more formal introduction. Catherine Cronin, Dr. Catherine Cronin, is a barrister, former academic with 36 years of experience in advocacy and policy and research. She's the joint head of Garden Court Chambers, which is one of the big chambers in London that does human rights work. She and Baljeet have just co-authored a study for the Law Centres Network report on unaccompanied children in the UK. I recommend it to you. It's called Put Yourself in Our Shoes, Considering Children's Best Interests in the Asylum System. And it was published last year. Catherine Cronin was admitted to practice in Australia and in the UK, and worked as an academic in Australia. She also was involved with the Australian Law Reform Commission and served as counsel to the Australian Parliament regarding migration. And she's lectured and published on children's law. Very well known for her representation of separated children, asylum-seeking children, and child victims of trafficking. The case that I saw with Catherine involved a child who was both seeking asylum and a victim of trafficking, and she was separated, all three things. Our other speaker is Baljeet Sandhu, who is the founding director of the Migrant and Refugee Children's Legal Unit, which is based at the Islington Law Centre. This is a specialist unit that advocates for separated children in the UK. It's the only one of its kind, as far as I know. And again, on a personal note, I started life as a solicitor in a law centre, so it's great that some law centres have survived and are still doing really good work. And Baljeet was also a student on a short course that we did here on child law. So very wonderful to see that she's now recognised as one of the leading children's rights solicitors in the field of asylum and immigration law, and she's specialised now in representing children for over 10 years. She's written a lot on these issues, delivers training to professionals. She serves on a number of boards and panels as an expert advisor. And she was awarded the Young Legal Aid Lawyer of the Year Award in 2011 for her work with refugee and migrant children. So they're both wonderfully qualified to talk about this subject. And we will aim to stop by 7:30 so that there will be questions and a period of question and answer at the end of the session.
If people can hear me, I think it's probably easier if I sit because that way Jenny can prompt me when I go over time. But we're delighted to be here this evening, in particular to speak about this topic, but also in particular to be giving this talk to Jenny, because as she's indicated, we've had a very wonderful relationship over time. Working both with her and her students, and for us it was a joy actually to see so many students who were really very engaged and also very effective in assisting us. I must say, in the case that Jenny refers to, the young trafficked victim, one of the students took the best note I have ever seen of a hearing. She pretty well got every word that the judge said in what was a nasty hearing, and I certainly relied on her notes when we went on appeal and we got that young woman a successful second appeal. So it's a great resource to have students who are prepared to assist us, because so little slack is available to us under legal aid. What we thought we would do this evening is just to sort of speak generally first. I'm going to just make some general observations, and then Baljeet is going to walk you through how children experience the asylum system in particular. And then I want to close talking about something that I find is often overlooked, but I think is enormously important, and that's to have some sensibility about the ethics of representation when you're representing children. I wanted to start, first of all, by we've titled this Only Half the Story, and it seems to me that at every point in this tale, one needs to have a look at the context in which these issues about children are occurring. And the first thing that I just want to draw attention to is to look at the issue of child migration in its context. And the context is one that has occurred over my lifetime. So it's not as if these patterns of migration are very ancient and old. They are modern patterns of migration. And the first thing that one should say, I think, particularly with all of the fuss at the moment about the EU, is that the first type of migration that you were getting into the UK in particular was free movement migration under the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth was a free movement, free trade organisation, and until the 1960s, anyone who was a British subject had a right to enter the UK. And it was on that basis that we got the first wave of migrants coming into the UK, and the only way in which that free trade, free movement arrangement, which was enormously significant in the 18th and 19th century into, as I said, much of the 20th century, was that, first of all, independent Commonwealth countries began making restrictions against certain types of British subjects, so Australia, Canada, and New Zealand and so forth, forging restrictions against Chinese migrants who were British subjects. And then of course the UK brought in its restrictions when the expulsion of Asians from East Africa meant that they considered that they no longer wanted that free movement provision. But it is really worth thinking about that history in the context of what is now seen as an aberrant arrangement with the EU free movement system. You've got a significant array of issues concerning refugee migrations in the Second World War, and the sort of restrictions that we now see against Syrians and the hostility that is expressed in respect of Syrians was expressed in the Second World War to Jewish refugees who were seeking to escape the Nazi regime. So you again have an almost identical parallel system for waves of refugee migration and a hostility that is engendered and created around those migrations. And then in the post-war system, you have, again, very interesting migration patterns. You have the Sylheti migration pattern from Bangladesh, where you have individual men coming as migrants and later sponsoring in their families. And we had years in which I cut my teeth as a immigration barrister doing Sylheti family reunions in contexts where the Home Office would dispute whether or not they were really related as claimed. The second type of migration that has been most important was the women's migration, particularly from the Caribbean. And that was considered to be quite unusual for individual single women to be migrating. And of course, since 2000, we have had child migration. And again, the unaccompanied child migration in particular. But each one of those patterns of migration has its genesis in, first of all, a facilitation of the migration, of pull factors that are intensely important, and also acute displacement and disruption that is engendering the sort of trade. And I did my PhD thesis on Chinese migration in the 19th century, and exactly the same debt bondage arrangements were being practiced in the 19th century as are being practiced now. It's an almost identical a carbon copy of those same, not just the migration patterns, but the arrangements that are facilitating migration. So again, while we have a lot of discussion about agents, smugglers and traffickers, and the mischief they create, informal migration has always existed, and it has always been facilitated by essentially persons who are making a profit out of moving people who otherwise can't afford it. The important thing I think to note about children's migration is just the data on it. I mean, over the years, in fact, there's been a fairly modest migration of children into Europe, and it's been a fairly steady steady pattern. It's obviously increased over the last year, but the countries that are receiving most unaccompanied children are Sweden, very definitely getting last year over 35,000. Germany has some 14,000, and the UK had 3,000, and that 3,000 is not as many as the UK was getting, for example, in 2008. So again, there's a lot of hype about numbers, but not necessarily shown, borne out in the figures. The other thing I think we tend to see unaccompanied child migration as being children who are coming over and who are coming over very often at about ages, between ages of 16 and 18, most of them boys, but not all, so that they've actually had a relatively short period of time in countries like the UK. There's a good deal of unaccompanied child migration that is hidden, and in particular, children who are brought in here and trafficked at very young ages, and who often live their entire lives here, and often are sent to school. So it isn't simply, it's important to see the context in which this child migration is occurring. But just on the sort of data on it, for example, in 2012, the data showed that over 50% of children's asylum cases are refused. Most of them are given a temporary stay until they're 17 and a half, but even then there are some children who are not even given that. But certainly at 17 and a half, the really significant refusal rates occur. And the data published last month, data that required a correction by the Minister of State for Immigration, about the numbers of young people removed, shows that 2,748 young people were removed in the past 9 years. The vast majority of those to Afghanistan, over 2,000 sent to Afghanistan, but also 60 sent to Iraq, which is a country that otherwise is a country deemed significantly unsafe.
And that was from 2014, when the UK government were aware that the so-called ISIS state were actually starting to briefly take over some parts of the region.
So, and we also have occasions, for example, where children are removed with parents, but also with parents who are incapable of looking after them. So we've had cases, for example, where children have been in the care system temporarily returned to their parents and removed with their parents. So there's a whole array of different ways in which children come to the notice of the Home Office, and very often in these cases we only find out when they've been removed rather than being brought to our attention by anyone in the Home Office. I could spend a lot of time talking about the legal framework, but I won't, because it is something that you can look up easily for yourselves. But just to say that one part of the story is to look at the legal framework, and there is a dense and extraordinary legal framework associated with asylum and trafficking. I think I've printed out 8 pages here, and they're just pages, they're just lists of particular international instruments, particular domestic laws, and over 2 pages of guidance from the UNHCR on different facets of the Refugee Convention. So in order to do this work, you really have to digest that array of legal guidance and legal provisions. And what one would say about it is that it has an enormously important role to play in terms of setting a framework and setting guidance that you can judge a case against. But what you always have to have regard to are the barriers that prevent people accessing the sort of protections that are writ large in those that guidance and those conventions. And I wanted to start, just as an introduction to what Baljeet is going to talk to you about, to what are the personal barriers to protection. Because one of the things that you really come to understand when you're representing children in particular, but almost all refugee claimants, is that no matter what the law makes provision for, no matter what beneficial and useful guidance is prepared, if there are not particular protections and particular arrangements and accommodations in place, the person really can't obtain the legal protection that is out there. And it's worthwhile noting that the way in which we have structured, and the developed world has structured its asylum systems in particular, is to have this very elaborate legalistic filtering system. And that is completely different to the developing countries of the world, which take charge of and take responsibility for 86% of the world's refugees. And we spend an inordinate amount of money screening people out, and money that could otherwise be put to good use is actually spent in sometimes the most punitive of procedures, that where you have a person who is highly traumatized to begin with, and the processes that they're required to undertake compound their trauma, compound their sense of alienation and so forth. But just as barriers that I think one needs to be alert to with almost every child, particularly almost any unaccompanied child, is first of all, the point of their departure. We did this report, as Jenny has said, which looked at a number of cases that had come through the law centre network. And so we were actually getting the lawyers to document an enormous amount of information about each and every case they were doing. And you can see in this sample, and in my practice as well, that I could probably count on one hand the number of children who were properly prepared for their departure. Most of them, it is sprung on them. Now, that may well be that it's happened at a crisis moment, but it can also be that they, from cultures where children are not necessarily engaged in decisions that are taken by adults, there can be a whole lot of reasons. But for whatever reason, most of these children depart with no sense of a chance to say goodbye. Most of them can't say goodbye to their siblings. They don't always see their mother. If you talk to them about what was said when they were leaving, it can cause them enormous stress because it was a moment that the whole world was lost, and yet it's not a moment that was in any sense given a significance or a preparation. And that lasts with a lot of these children, and it lasts in the context of their continuing notion of their relationships with their families. The second thing that you have to be aware of is the journey. And again, in my experience, the journey is horrendous. I mean, we now see it on our television, so we have some sense of the magnitude. But those trials of those problems have been going on for years. Children seeing their siblings drown. Children, I had a boy who was accompanied by an older cousin, specially arranged by his parents so he'd be protected. He was only 13. They got under the chassis of a lorry, and his cousin was too big, and he dropped out and was killed. And so this little boy stays underneath the lorry and comes in and has had that occur on his journey. I mean, that would be just one story, but you could have countless stories of being beaten, of being forced into labour relations en route, confined in refrigerated lorries and having no sense at all of where they were going. And again, in our experience, most of these children didn't know where they were going, and it was only at some stage in the journey, largely through the direction of an agent or in their consultation with other migrants who were being helped to move, that they fix upon the destination. And they decide they want to go to Germany or Sweden or the UK. But those decisions are not decisions, generally speaking, in our experience, that are made in advance of their journey. So it is really just sending children into a system of complete uncertainty. The other thing is the children's lack of knowledge. And when they arrive here, the only knowledge they've acquired about our processes is what's been told to them by other migrants or by agents. And that's often corrupted knowledge and inappropriate knowledge, because it can encourage them to change parts of their stories. But they certainly have no knowledge of the sort of processes that they're going to meet. The sort of agent controls, and again, the brutality of some of the agents, the fact that, again, the agents change. So there isn't any point at which you have an adult who is taking care of these children. And again, they can spend a long period of time locked in houses, and then suddenly a new agent comes and takes them on the next stage of the journey. Most of them, in my experience, have had some trauma, and some of them an extraordinary trauma in the journey, and most of them, again, in my experience, are very reluctant to talk about it, and it can take a long, long time before they have the capacity to tell you the sorts of things that happen in my, we know that girls are frequently raped en route. We also are coming to understand just the number of boys who are raped, but boys who are really very, very reluctant to speak about it. Numbers of these children, particularly the Afghani boys, come from countries where age is largely irrelevant and certainly not something that you note and celebrate and record, and yet the first thing as Baljeet will tell you that they step into is a very elaborate age assessment. And the second thing that I would say, the final thing that is the barrier to their receiving protection, is the way we structure narratives. And it never ceases to amaze me how the Home Office obsession with sequencing, when did something occur and when did the next thing occur, and also counting people who came into the room, counting people who visited, counting people you're on the lorry with, whatever. So it's all about concrete markers that are very, very important. And I used to, particularly when we were dealing with a lot of Somali refugees, and you knew that because of the civil disturbance in Somalia, most of them were living indoors in the most unremittingly sane daily activities for months and months and months on end. And yet the Home Office expected them to have measured time, to have taken a note of the date, to have taken a note of which event occurred first and how long it lasted for. And it is just, and it's the same with Afghani boys who come from these little rural villages. And, you aren't going to have your calendar in your kitchen and be looking and saying it's Friday afternoon, 2 p.m. when these people come. So it's just the inappropriateness of what we value in the investigation process. And of course, many of the children fall short. And then they're falling short of a paradigm that we have set is held against them. So I think I'm going to end there because I want Baljeet to have plenty of time to talk to you about.
Thank you, Catherine. And I think just following on from that, what I wanted to do is to talk about the punitive, elaborate system that Catherine's mentioned. And that was really at the heart of why we decided to do this project. And I'll just tell you a little bit about the project, which it was basically the fact that for far too long, a lot of professionals had no idea about the lives that the children were living and the various legal processes that they were journeying through, which isn't just the asylum process. And so with that in mind, what we wanted to do was actually put the heart of the child at a longitudinal study, which lasted for 2 years, involved 15 law centres around the UK, where they analysed and recorded detailed information around the experiences of children prior to arrival, following their arrival, and their journey through parallel asylum and care processes. And from that, we were able to get a lot of some really detailed information about and understand the lives that the journeys that they were going through. And with that, I mean, it was a year of data that was collected, but I thought I'd begin by starting with two of the quotes, one from a child from the report and one from a lawyer, which I think goes some way to really set the scene of what we're looking at, and just following on from what Catherine has very eloquently summarised. So the quote from the child in the report: "It's like when you come here, you are blind. Then you get a stick to help you to go. Because you don't know the language. The words, they don't work. And you don't know the way. By the time you find out, you are refused. And Put Yourself in Your Shoes, which is the title of this report, was taken directly from one of the quotes. And it also sets some context as to why the majority of unaccompanied asylum-seeking children seeking international protection in the UK are refused asylum, refused any humanitarian protection, and we are looking at a state where young people are actually being removed once they attain the age of majority to countries where they're known conflict zones. And then I thought by just starting with a quote from one of the lawyers: "You then find yourself sitting across the table from a vulnerable young car youth, afraid and alone, having been dropped off at your door by social services. They may be bewildered, even distant, trying to grapple with why they are there to see you. You try your best to reassure them, comfort them in another official and alien environment. You communicate through another adult, hoping that your sensitive approach to interpreting and questioning will be properly conveyed to the child. Try to make them feel at ease before you begin questioning them on events that may cause them pain. Ask them about loved ones that they have lost or left behind and details of the violence they may have witnessed, suffered or fear. You fear that your questioning may be causing them further harm, watching them become overwhelmed, distressed, withdrawn or even angry. And I think the reason why it's important to set that scene is that the asylum system and the protection system in the UK is a very, very elaborate system which was created for adult asylum seekers. It was not equated with children in mind. The simplest way I can say that it gives any protection to children or professors to is the fact that add-on is that the child has the right to bring their legal representative and a responsible adult to the asylum interview. Aside from that, there really is no other mechanism where child-specific issues are being considered. Equally, we have decision makers from the Home Office and asylum lawyers who are trying their best to actually work within elaborate frameworks of legislative frameworks, but most of them will maybe, if at all, have a couple of hours training on all the legislation and all of the frameworks that Catherine mentioned around what may be relevant to any child's claim. There is no training to deal with the relational aspects of these traumatised children, often incredibly, suffering at least emotional disturbance at the very least. We have no training on understanding developmental issues and aspects surrounding children, let alone their particular needs. And that's the system we're talking about where we're starting to think about representing these children. So what I wanted to do then is just to maybe walk you through the way that through the processes through the lens of the child as soon as they arrive, following the traumatic events of, either pre-flight or on their journey and final arrival to the UK. So the first thing the child will, following arrival, is the identification phase. And they'll either be detected by police or immigration officials at port, largely at seaport, at the ports of Dover, or through airports. But they're meeting strangers, adults, and a lot of them will feel an immediate elation to be in a safe country, but they are in an alien environment. And what with the and this is where the elaborate system starts and the punitive questioning starts. The child is then questioned about their identity and why they're here. And those questions can be bewildering. They're in an environment where they don't really understand what's going on, but they're trying their best. Unfortunately, what happens is some children are held until they are referred to social services and into the care of a local authority, but often children are detained for a long time. Many years ago, our practices, we represented lots of children in Kent who had been detained by immigration officials on arrival, having been in horrific conditions. Someone as young as 9 years old being detained for up to 2 days with G4 security guards as responsible adults, questioning them, and those interviews were then later used to discredit them in their international protection claims. We were successful in our challenge because the children were not being referred to the relevant children's services departments, and immediately the then immigration minister did announce that children needed their immediate humanitarian needs dealt with and at least have time to rest and recuperate before being interrogated. I mean, it was a slight win at the time. But what we have, sadly, Her Majesty's Prison Inspectorate, so there's a report published last week. Unfortunately, because of the rise in numbers, children have been detained up to 2 days in freight sheds in Folkestone without any access to immediate humanitarian, their basic needs being met. So it's, again, a cycle, this constant cycle. So once the child is then identified by this official, they are then, there's three things will happen. The child will then be asked the questions. As Catherine mentioned, the first thing that will happen is they will, the immigration officials will start checking their credibility and also challenging, often, particularly young people from Afghanistan, in our experience, their very identity and challenge their age. So what could happen is that the immigration official accepts the child's age, takes down the details and refers the child to social services for them to be placed in the UK care system, or they may actually dispute the child's age. And the age assessment is carried out by an immigration official who's not trained again to work with children, and it's purely on a physical appearance assessment. And if they feel that the child isn't under 18, two things can happen. They can, if they've articulated a claim for international protection, they may be channeled and dispersed to another part of the UK where they're accommodated with adult asylum seekers. However, if the young person has not articulated a claim or articulated a fear or claimed asylum, and they've been found to be 18, they may be removed to the country of embarkation within 24 hours, and we've recently learned that that has been happening, because there were secret and which we outed, but gentlemen's agreements between two-party states, France and the UK, and Belgium and the UK, where individuals can be removed to the country of embarkation if they're not claiming asylum on port. So that's the initial phase when the child's arrived. So let's turn to whether, if the child is accepted as a child, is referred to the social services. Social services are responsible for children who have no adult to care for them and they're in need. So largely supported under Section 20 of the Children Act provisions in the UK. The child would then be, their immediate and humanitarian needs would be met, food and shelter, but then the child will enter into further assessments and further interviews, another elaborate legal framework. And this is where child in need assessments will take place. Largely twofold. The first part of that assessment is where the local authority and the social workers will then assess the age of the child. Sadly, we've had cases, and in our experience, particularly in particular areas, these age assessments are routine. The child may know their date of birth, they may even have a document proving their date of birth, but social services will carry out age assessments because they need to say that they have, in order to prove why they're able to provide their support to the young person. Because often, more often than not, they're expected to do them because they then have to communicate that information to the Home Office. Unfortunately, unlike any other resource programme, usually local authorities are funded through local government for their support for any child in their care. When it comes to unaccompanied asylum seeking children, the Home Office hold the purse strings. And so local authorities do have to report to the Home Office within particular time frames in order to be funded for the children that they're going to be supporting. That does have an impact on the way that communication and the reason why communication is being shared, rather than focusing on the child. It's the whole bureaucracy around it all.
Can I just interrupt there and just say one thing too about age assessments? Is that it's quite common to see children given the age the 1st of January of whatever year. So they may in fact have been born in August, but you already discounted 8 months in terms of their maturation. And that is a relatively common practice, but also almost all ages are estimations. And again, you know, you have decisions taken in terms of removal at the age of 17 and a half on the basis of the assessed age. So whether or not the person is actually 17 and a half is an utterly moot point. Mm-hmm. So, as we all know, for teenagers, mm-hmm. 8 or 9 months can be a very important difference in terms of their maturity and capacity to cope.
And unfortunately, the whole age assessment process is such a contentious and a litigious area, and it's for many years has been left to the courts to actually hand down guidance around how lawful assessment should take place. And because of that, I mean, in our experience where we've represented children where they've been age assessed, we often get those age assessments overturned. All unaccompanied children should be given the right to challenge their age assessment, be it by the social workers, and should be informed of that right. But sadly, more often than not, children are not challenging those assessments because they have no idea about the information that's just been relayed to them, what they're supposed to do with it, and sadly there isn't any expert lawyers, because asylum lawyers can't challenge those assessments. There's not enough lawyers who are experts in that field. So often children are left to settle with the age that's been given to them. And so that's arrival. You know, that's their arrival. We haven't even begun the asylum system yet, and they're having to deal with all of these, you know, repetitive questioning and interviewing and assessments. And so if a child is, and their age is accepted, and setting aside the age assessment, that then the child in need assessment, the second part of the assessment, is really about considering their particular and specific needs. And for a long time, there was no guidance, to social workers, just silence on the particular and distinct needs of these children who have often suffered violence or harm. But in July 2014, finally the Department for Education, and we welcomed new guidance for social workers to understand that they need to think about the particular needs and histories of these children in order to make the necessary referrals to relevant professionals. So as part of this second assessment, there will be referrals made to various professionals. And this is before the young person has even begun to understand what asylum is and even accessing a legal representative. So assessments will then be made to a number of professionals, and the first assessment is really about health. So common routine practice for young people to then be referred to a GP. Unfortunately, in our experience, there's lots of barriers to communication. Social workers don't necessarily attend those appointments with young people, particularly the older teenagers. And because of language difficulties, fears that the young person have of yet again meeting another stranger, that they're not actually opening up to, so that their health needs aren't being met. In terms of mental health referrals, there is massive research and evidence to suggest that unaccompanied children from war-torn countries are likely to be suffering some form of trauma. And there's massive research to say any unaccompanied migrant child, be they asylum-seeking child, who has suffered separation or loss, has at the very least suffered some emotional disturbance. In our report, lawyers were grappling with this. They were concerned about the child, how they were behaving, but they're not experts. Most of them found there were some emotional concerns, concerns over their emotional well-being. But like in the findings from the report, and our experiences more generally, hardly any children are referred to mental health services at all. We had 4 out of the 60 in our case sample that were referred to mental health services. And this is just across the board. And having experts and, you know, specialised and trained in children is absolutely vital to understand the capacity and the needs of these children and their ability to participate in elaborate processes and just have their needs met. Unfortunately, one of the barriers is also resource. We find that there's a dearth of professionals who are allocated to young people. We heard last week, for example, the one-day-a-week service that was providing mental health services to hundreds and hundreds of children in Kent will close at the end of the month because it has no funding. Often children are referred into CAMHS, which is the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service provision. That's a breaking point for British children, let alone unaccompanied children, and waiting lists, and largely in our experience they won't take referrals unless there's evidence of suicidal ideation. And so we're talking about traumatised young people who may not be accessing the support that they need. Then also referrals will need to be, and then the placements happen, and that's where they may be placed with foster families, yet another set of adults that they're meeting. They may be placed in semi-independent accommodation where they're actually with other young people from all the different parts of the world. And so, and they're also then referred to for education provision. Sadly, what we are finding that in our experience, young people just want to live normal lives. They want to try and just be a normal teenager, be with other young people, but sadly, access to education isn't that easy. If a child arrives in the middle of the year, there's certain social services may not be able to make the applications in time, so the young person isn't going to school. But we've had major concerns of late, where children, young people, particularly between the ages of 16 and 18, have no access to further education whatsoever. And this is happening particularly in Kent, where hundreds of young people are not accessing provision because there's a number of reasons. One, the colleges have decided that they are disbanding their low-level entry courses and their ESOL courses. But the large concern for us is the fact that the local authorities refusing to pay disbursements for the children to be able to travel to colleges. So they're being prohibited from accessing education, which is a fundamental aspect a fundamental need for them, especially for the developmental needs. And this is before the child's even entered the system of the legal process in terms of the asylum system.
Can I just point you're getting back in a sense to age assessment? One of the problems of age assessments is that the people who are doing it, either the Home Office or the social services, both have a vested interest in finding you older than you might be. And in particular, the placement of what sort of accommodation is assigned to a child depends on the age. So we will. Ilka some years ago did a very wide-ranging interviews of social workers, and many of them said they were under extraordinary pressure to find a child over 16, because at over 16 they can go into semi-independent accommodation and not into foster care, and so it's considerably cheaper. And so there are all of these pressures being brought to bear in terms of again the assignment of appropriate accommodation to children.
And it's then that the final referral, which should be made immediately, but we've learned that often delayed for a very, very long period because of the lack of asylum lawyers able to represent, particularly because of the increase of numbers and also because there's a dearth of asylum lawyers in particular areas where the numbers are large, particularly the gateway authorities, so children aren't being referred to lawyers. But is when they actually then finally enter, are referred to the Home Office for their claim for international protection to be lodged. Unfortunately, some children are entering that system. It's just to give you a brief overview, what basically happens is that when a screening interview happens, a child is interviewed about and some questions asked about, and it's the official lodging of that claim. They then get sent away with forms to complete, to submit back to the Home Office, who will then interview them with the contents of all that information before them. They may then be refused after the interview, refused, or their application is successful. If refused, they have a right to appeal. They have the right to a legal representative. It's the one protective measure to have a lawyer with them. We're finding that our study found that most children are unrepresented at the screening stage, despite having the right to have a lawyer there. Often, sometimes without even a responsible adult with them or a social worker, but often, most often not with a social worker or key worker who they've just met that morning. Once in the system, that's when the lawyers are having to start to meet with the child, gather the evidence, and start preparing their international protection claim. At the same time, their parallel lives of actually trying to be a normal young person, moving from a foster placement to independent accommodation, having parallel age assessments going on from social services. This is all happening at the same time for these children. And this is how punitive and elaborate the system is. And they're expected to know their claims, articulate their claims for protection, know the details of their histories and their family's history, and be able to articulate in with that. And so the major findings that we found from our report that I would highlight before I end is the fact that the stark finding was that all of these professions, and there are many, hardly have any contact with each other, and they don't. They're completely disconnected. We found that often they've never even spoken. And what we have is we're in a position where lawyers who are untrained to work with children are the custodians of what are protection assessments, without any input from child-trained experts. be they mental health experts, be they social workers. So you've just got lawyers trying to grapple with and prepare these children's cases. And they've got these array of adults rotating around them. And that really, for us, was one of the key findings of that study. And on top of that, and the backdrop of that, is we've had some horrific cuts to legal aid, which has resulted in children, so it's resulted in one particular hit for unaccompanied asylum-seeking children is that the government decided that human rights claims would be fragmented. So if there's a claim for asylum or international protection under Article 3 of the European Convention of Human Rights, you have legal aid. But if there's any claims under the Article 8, which is the right to a private and family life, then there's no legal aid. So lawyers are actually carving up children's human rights for fear of not being paid. And there's been a lot of confusion being created of what actually they can gather evidence. So when they're thinking about best interest evidence, the evidence of all these professionals, it's for fear of not being paid, they are not actually gathering the evidence. And there's often horrific restrictions on trying to get funding for experts' reports as well. And that really is where the child's voice is lost within the whole system, and they really don't have any agency.
Well, I'm going to just very briefly, yes, no, we want to leave time for questions, but I just want to say a couple of things. Part of the issue about lawyering for children is that one of the skills that you need is a sort of an empathic skill to sort of have a sense of the child and the child's experiences before you, but also to undertake quite detailed country research so that you know the sort of background that the children come to. And one of the things that we've done out of this project is that happily some funders have given money so that we actually start training law centres, because they are probably the last residue of workers who are able to represent children. And we find that they are incredibly receptive to training, but there are certain things that aren't necessarily, they're not necessarily alerted to. And one of them is just the importance of actually, once you know from the screening document where the child comes from, you ought to actually throw yourself in that child's village. It's now very easy with Google to actually find out where they are. Usually have pictures, you have a whole series of, even the tidiest of Afghani villages are usually up there in some form or another. And it's a talking point with the child at the first interview. It's also important to have an understanding of how they've come to the country, because if we have a chambers where you have a lot of conference rooms in a basement, but if I have a child who's come here in a lorry and hasn't been long out of the lorry, I'm not going to take them into a basement room, because it may not be very conducive to them feeling that they can disclose their tales to me. So you have to have that sensibility. But the children who, I think for most lawyers, for most of us working in these sorts of fields, the problems that we have arise from the nature of the trafficking system, and I use trafficking in both its specific meaning and its general meaning. Most of these children have come here because some money has been paid for their journey. And very often that money has meant that the family has gone into debt. Sometimes they will have land or something to sell, and so they can pay the cost of the journey outright. But very often the journey is either funded in stages or they've actually gone into debt. And that debt is a very powerful mechanism in all of those migration models in terms of holding the family hostage, if you like, for the child to be able ultimately to repay that debt. And what you find is that children, particularly the children who come here via debt bondage, and they can be Afghani children, they're very often Asian children, Vietnamese and Chinese children, you will find that they are very, very reluctant to tell you anything about their circumstances, because if they are going to disclose information about their traffickers, their families are at risk. And so it does create an ethical issue for lawyers, because lawyers, the paradigm for lawyers is that you have a client who tells you their tale, and you go in and you are the spokesperson for that client in court, and you are able to convey to the judge what the child's or the adult's story is. And that doesn't really happen with children. First of all, you get these are teenagers, and they're very reluctant to talk about emotional things to people they don't know very well, like their lawyers. So that is one set of problems, but also they may very much feel anxious about putting their family at risk. And trafficked children are very often, in my experience, frequently still under the control of the traffickers when they come to us, because it can be in the interest of the trafficker to get them here legally so that they can continue to be exploited. So there's a whole series of problems that make eliciting the story of the client very difficult. And what we are seeking to do through this project is to get the immigration tribunals and lawyers' associations generally to rethink the ethics of representation for children. And in the United States, they have developed a system that we think is actually quite sensible. If you're representing children in the family division, you often speak about a best interest model. So the lawyer decides what is in the child's best interest, and even though the child doesn't want that outcome, you as their lawyer can decide it's the best thing for them. So you advocate that they stay with dad rather than mum or whatever, even though the child is telling you something different. That model, I think, is really dangerous. Because lawyers are not necessarily good judges of a child's best interests. But what the American lawyers have said is that lawyers should be able to argue for any tenable legal outcome for the child. So even if they are not telling you that they are trafficked, and that is very, very common, or even if they are suffering a mental illness that limits their capacity to disclose, you can indicate to the judge that you want the judge to consider the case as a trafficking case, and if the evidence is there to decide that the child is a victim of trafficking. And so that is sort of turning legal representation, if you like, on its head. But it seems to us to be a restrained model, an ethical model, and a model that has regard to the fact that so many of these children, when you are representing them, are not going to be sometimes capable or sometimes willing or, as they see it, necessarily able to disclose to you all of the factors in their life that mean if they were removed from the UK, they are going to be very seriously at risk of harm. And it is particularly with some of these young trafficking victims where you know that not only are they at risk of harm in their home countries, that they're very much at risk of harm here, that you have this, I think, very strong desire to bend the ethical advocacy rules so that you can at least get for them the status of refugee or the status of being a victim of trafficking, and both of those status identities allow for the child to be given some limited leave to remain, and in the case of refugees, ultimately to succeed in getting indefinite leave to remain and getting settlement. I think it's at 7:30, so we might finish there and have the rest of the time for questions.
Yes, so we have half an hour for questions, and I think there will be quite a few questions. I see people here who know a lot about this issue, and I'll take two or three questions at a time, and if necessary I'll repeat them so that people at the back can hear them, but if you speak up loud and clear, we will be able to do that.
Yes. So I just jump in, Jojo, thank you so much, it was absolutely fascinating, and you clearly both have such a huge amount of knowledge and experience, and it's just a real thank you for such a detailed presentation. I just wondered, and I don't know if you will have thoughts on this, but about the immigration bill and the new provisions for care leavers, and I wonder if you could just say something about that, and then briefly, and also how that might affect your role, you know, how you kind of represent.
I forgot to say, please give your name and affiliation if you have any.
My name is Rachel Humphreys. I'm working on a project called Becoming Adult with my colleague. which is researching and accompanying asylum seeking children's uncertain futures. So we're looking at Albanians, Vietnamese, Afghans, and Eritreans.
This question at the back.
I'm Bronwyn Mandy, I'm a visiting fellow at the Centre for Human Rights. I have a question relating to nationality, which is my field of work. And first of all, the situation of children whose nationality or origin is not established, who may be stateless, and questions of deportation and what happens to them, what additional complication that creates for the child. But then secondly, the other half of the equation is that the children who have arrived here as children, what is their access to British nationality? Or is it any different from that of adults who have arrived and gone through the asylum system?
Yes, that was a very good question. So those one here, the one was about the new immigration bill, and the other was about the same sort of stateless children that arrive in the UK.
I'll kick off at the Balkan. We do the becoming adult one first. The immigration bill that is before Parliament is an absolute disaster in every respect for migrants and refugees. It really is. But one of the most pernicious parts of it is what is being done in respect of young adults. I mean, the government seems to have this view. It's one thing to have your immigration control model actually working to put in a regulated system so people have to get visas, they're checked on arrival and so forth. What they've done is that they've brought in highly punitive, discriminatory arrangements so that your capacity to live here is really significantly diminished. And what it is a punishing system to try to force people to leave. And so you now, under a whole series of legislation, you can't rent your property, you can't take employment, obviously, you can't drive a car, you can't access health services, the children can't access education, and the new addition to this panoply of discriminatory arrangements is to ensure that children, once they reach the age of 18, are excluded from support by local authorities. And what we have had for really a lengthy period of time, since the 1980s, is the sense that when children have been looked after and are in the care system as children, that you start with the presumption, first of all, that they are vulnerable. You also know that they are without parents or guardians to assist them. And therefore, the state has got a responsibility in loco parentis to assist them not only as children, but also into young adulthood so that they can get on their feet in the same way that a parent would assist their child through the education system. And that has been really a really significantly beneficial system for children leaving care. And it was, it came about through a lot of campaigning by children who had been in the care system themselves, talking about the difficulties that they had. And so this is now going to be denied to children who are here as unaccompanied, a failed asylum seeker for children. And of course, what that means is that, first of all, when we start with the presumption that their age assessment is probably inaccurate, they may still be children at the point at which you deny them assistance and accommodation. They will be without accommodation. They will be without support. They will no longer be able to attend schools. And very often these kids are still in the appeal process, because what happens with children, and because the lawyering is at such a poor level and so variable across the country, very often the legal aid lawyers, when a child puts in a claim for asylum and is refused as a 14-year-old, for example, but they are given discretionary leave to the age of 17 and a half, the lawyer simply can't be bothered to go ahead with the appeal. So there isn't an appeal against the refusal of asylum. And so the child is having to, at the age of 17 and a half, renew that application and get a positive a decision on the through the appeal system on their asylum case. Now, those children are going to be denied support while that claim is being pursued, and they literally will have no support. I mean, it is going to be, you will see so many homeless children, homeless young adults, as a result of this initiative. So it is terrible, truly, truly terrible. The other thing, of course, in the bill is it enables children to be removed to their home country and to be forced to have their appeal outside of the UK. Now, that won't happen to them if they're seeking asylum or international protection, but it will affect them if what they're claiming is that they have attachments and a private or family life in the UK. And these trafficked children in particular are likely to be in that circumstance because so many of these young children brought in as maids when they're 8 and 9 years old have been to school, have all of their school friends here, have had all of their life here, and their claim is a claim under private life rights, and now they will be returned to Nigeria or Ghana or somewhere to have their appeal. So in the end, a really disastrous and detrimental initiative in this bill. And the third thing that's in the bill is the capacity not only to relocate and redistribute children when they come in as claimants, so that, and we actually support this, I mean, Kent and Croydon, for example, so Gatwick and Folkestone get a huge number of young asylum seekers, and they don't manage it well, and they are thoroughly in bed with the Home Office, so the redistribution could actually be beneficial. But it's another thing to decide that you're going to redistribute a child refugee. So you just get them here, they sort of form some attachments as they've gone through the appeal process, which is almost always going to be at least a year. And then when you give them refugee status, you move them somewhere completely different. So it is just punitive. There is no other description for it. It's really very, very dreadful.
I think what I'll just do, just add 2 points to that, including everything that Cassie's highlighted. The first thing is, in our lobbying work, we've had young people meeting with peers to really push for change in SIMPs. This is effectively ousting children in the care system out of care provisions. And that's what's happening. Whilst on one hand, we've got a system where we're actually bringing up the age of responsibility, so staying put arrangements, recognising that the local authority has a responsibility, like any parent would, to support a young person up to the age of 25 or 18 or beyond in a foster placement to save their families. You are ousting these children out. So that's what I just wanted to add. The other thing that I would probably add is, just following on from what Catherine's just said, I think the only way I can describe, there's the unaccompanied asylum-seeking children who have arrived, who have claimed asylum, and for the reasons we've discussed, are likely not to have been granted asylum. If they have, if for example, lawyers have not submitted appeals, they've got limited leave to remain, they're then expected to make further applications. They've got to then access legal aid to do that. In our experience, lawyers are saying you were refused asylum last time now. This one's an Article 8 case, so there's no legal aid, so you're unrepresented and you don't actually have anyone helping you with an application. So the numbers of refused asylum-seeking young people at the age of 18 is going to increase because of the parallel legal aid cuts. That's a reality. And the only other thing that I would just add is, and this is a simple way of explaining it in terms of the non-asylum seeking children. Victoria Climbing, if she was alive and protected at the time from the abusive carers that she was in, the care that she was in, she would have gone into the care system at the age of 4 or 5 years old. She would be the responsibility of the local authority. We see these cases every day. These children have lived in foster families. They don't even know they've got immigration status issues. The local authority are responsible for dealing with their immigration problem. We have seen cases where they hit 18, the young people are hitting 18, and social workers are turning around saying, sorry, you've got no immigration status, and the child's been in their care since they were 2 years old. It's their responsibility to deal with their immigration status. We actually put that to the ministers, because we know and they admitted, local authorities do keep statistics on unaccompanied asylum-seeking children because they have to. there is no obligation for local authorities to keep or record the records of non-asylum seeking children in their care. So there may be lots of children who may not have any immigration status at the age of 18.
And that answer takes the nationality one. It goes very close to the... Because one of the things that the local authorities could do... I mean, the last little vestige of benevolence for children is in the Nationality Act, Section 3.1. Section 3.1 allows the Secretary of State to make any child a British citizen, and the wording in the statute is, if he thinks fit... And for those of you who are of a certain age will remember that Zola Budd got her British citizenship in that via that route, with no connections at all to the UK, but just because she was seen at that stage to be potentially an Olympic medal winner. So you literally can make any child a British citizen. Now, that used to be very well... the decision-making under the unit that was dealing with those nationality claims was really fairly benign, and we could expect to get a lot of these children British citizenship, children in the care system, children who were looked after, children adopted abroad, surrogate-born children born abroad, a whole host of children who potentially could get citizenship via that route. What we have found in the last 8 months is that obviously the word has gone out that has been rather too generous, so we're now getting lots and lots of refusals out of that particular unit. So it and what that will translate into is judicial reviews of those decisions, because they are essentially unreasonable decisions, because many of these children... meet the guidance for nationality instructions, but it's really very very important to have regard to a child's nationality and indeed all of their nationalities. I mean, the first thing I always want to know about anyone who I'm dealing with is with an immigration problem is what their nationality is, because you need to know what countries they can enter and live in, and if they don't have a nationality. And what we are finding throughout the world, really, is that there are so many children who might well have a nationality, but they can't establish it. And the UNHCR refers to them as de facto stateless. And that is a proper assessment of their situation. I've had children who really don't know their nationality, have no idea. I had a boy once who was... told me, and I think with the utmost honesty in terms of his own assessment, is that he was from Gaza. And everything he told me about his childhood made very clear to me that he was very definitely from Algeria. But he genuinely didn't know that, and he had no papers, he had no capacity, he'd been working in oil drilling in the Sahara since he was about 7 years old. Working in Europe, just on the move in Europe for many, many years. Very, very traumatised boy. And there is just no... He had no papers that could ever have established his nationality. And his self-identity was incredibly confused and very, very distressing for him. So these nationality problems are very significant. If you look at the... Convention on the Rights of the Child, it is really very significant that they combine as identity rights, nationality and family, as well as ethnicity. So those three things combine to make us alert to who we are. And there are very significant problems for children without it. Can I say that it's a problem in the immigration tribunals that they tend to have a very... restrictive approach to nationality questions and essentially impute nationality to children and to adults, I must say, as well, even where the nationality can't be established. The Home Office does language tests, many of which are by discredited organisations to try and assign a nationality to children, even though they have a perfectly good reason for being able to explain why their dialect may well be Kurdish Iraqi, but they were born in the Kurdish region of Syria. So, you know, the nationality is right. The only point at which this de facto nationality actually becomes something that can be allowed a child to remain is if the country that the Home Office is seeking to return them to doesn't accept them as a national of that country. And what is happening is that immigration departments around the world are bribing these countries to take people back. So you may have no papers. I've had children who have. I mean, I had a child who was assigned Kenyan nationality. His dad was Kenyan. He wasn't born in Kenya. His mother was murdered. He had absolutely no identity with that country whatsoever. But they were very determined to get him back to Kenya. And until we were, by a war of attrition, got him permission to stay here, they would have got Kenya to take him back. And so when these children are returned, if they are under emergency travel documents, without, again, any proper identity papers, they are living as stateless persons in those countries, and particularly in countries where you need to have identity documents to access any services whatsoever. So it is a terrible, terrible problem, and it's particularly vexed for children. Okay, time for more questions. Sorry, it's just one of my
hobbies. I just wanted to open the floor to anybody who has one or two last questions. We only have about another 10 minutes. Yes, there's one here and one at the back. Question?
Yeah, I'm Sheila Miles, like how working at charity that works with young people is homeless and kids. And this is a very simplistic question, but I'd like you both to say something about the relationship between politics and the law, and I'm thinking in my head of two things. One is the refugees or the people who are in Calais or people who are in Europe at the moment, and it's totally illegal according to European law that they should be pushed out, but the government seems to agree that they should be pushed back. But also in my work every day I think about the Convention of the Rights of the Child, and you know, in my workplace there are articles from that all over the walls. And the Article 3 is about best interests. And I do not understand the relationship between the fact that the British government has signed this and Kent Social Services and Croydon Social Services and Lambeth do not follow the best interests of children. Mm-hmm. And so the way in which government has more power than the law and what lawyers do about it, that's my question.
There's one more question about that. We're going to have to try and keep the answers to this short, which is kind of difficult. Yes.
You mentioned earlier on about kind of ousting and that we almost creating this two-tiered, well, we are creating a two-tiered system whereby we have the children, the British nationality, British children, sorry, are maybe given the special treatment over non-British. And I'm just kind of wondering if that seems very lawful. It's also kind of going on from that also within an education environment. We're experiencing, so I should say, I'm from the British Red Cross, we're experiencing situations where actually education providers and provision are basically placed on discretionary kind of applications of who should or shouldn't be applying for their place in schools or colleges. And therefore, what can we do about this? If it's unlawful, it's happening, and who do you go to kind of advocate that this is unlawful?
You're from British Red Cross,
yeah.
You said, So we're going to have to try and answer these impossible questions very quickly.
The thing about, and you're absolutely right, that the Refugee Convention has been clouded every day of the week now. I mean, all you can do is challenge it in courts. That's the system that we have, is to have courts the point at which governments are held accountable. Mm-hmm. But there's so much misunderstanding and so much misinformation and so much deliberate engendering of hostility that governments can act with impunity in a sense because they trade on people's fears. So it is
it is really a problematic situation. But it's the reason why legal aid is significant is that it allows ordinary people to access courts and to use those courts to challenge decisions. Once you strip that away, they can't even, and once you put very high fees, which is the other part of the mischief, is that you have to pay now significant amounts of money to get access to a court. And for all of these are really deliberately contrived barriers to denying you access to justice, and they're also deliberately contrived barriers that allow governments to flout laws themselves and cannot be held accountable. And so, you know, I'm with Bernie Sanders. I think we should all take back democracy, because it really is, it has been hijacked and it has been removed from ordinary people by all of these mechanisms that deny ordinary people the one little hope they have to be able to exercise their rights, and that's get access to a court. You have no other way.
And I just literally would follow from that. You know, when it feels unfair, it probably is. It's about the accountability. And that's where a very, very contrived, very clever attempt to stop access to justice.
And judicial review. Yes. You know, that you have to have, you know, a period of residence, a lawful residence, before you can access judicial review. The very mechanism that is there to challenge government's decisions. So that it's been a very, very clever strategy by this government in particular, and it's a very clever strategy that is designed to make sure people can't challenge their decision making. Mm-hmm. Very worried.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add one thing, which is that when I started working in law centres, that was what we were there for. Mm-hmm. And there was very wide access to legal aid. Mm-hmm. And watching over the years as this has got steadily cut back, the kind of cases we did, it would no longer be possible to do.
Yeah.
And then there was the other question.
And just the other question, yes. Absolutely, again, accountability of, I mean, there are statutory provisions that are responsibilities for local authorities to ensure that young people are accessing relevant provision, education provision, and equally monitoring, you know, the types of access to that provision. So again, unlawful needs to be investigated and dependent upon if other avenues of access to education are being provided. If there's barriers, then somebody needs to be held to account. And so I think that's really about first understanding what those barriers are. Is it the local authority, or is it the... I mean, we're seeing impunity in academies, particularly, who feel they can just, you know, have a free-for-all and have no responsibilities, but actually it is accountability. But going back to legal aid, and how do we do it? Education was taken out of legal aid altogether, even for British children. So that's the difficulty, is that we now find thousands and thousands of British children unlawfully excluded from schools, who are now not accessing, you know, legal aid. We had lawyers at the Law Centre who did education work, who monitored their casework prior to the cuts, and most cases were dealt with once a legal intervention with a letter to the school, and that got the child back in. And now you have no access to any support as families or as young people to lawyers to hold people to hold educational institutes to account.
And was there one other question? We could just have a very quick one more question. Firstly, I'm sure I will do that draft. Topic of research on the use of the sort of medicalization of the language involved in exam applications, including the increasing reliance on language data, particularly to do with age. And as we know, this is happening in the UK, then also sort of how can you create space where truth is being derived from the scientific account rather than their body or these others?
Well, no, I mean, the age assessment, the fights that we've had over age assessments and these sort of x-rays and various other mechanisms to predict age.
it's a huge battle, I must say. I mean, the useful thing in terms of at least X-ray is that they have accepted that it is an assault if you X-ray a child without the anesthetic. So that sort of still is a little bit of a marker. But yes, I mean, it's again things like the language testing. It's putting a sort of pseudoscience around factors associated, particularly with identity, and so you know what we need are experts who challenge that pseudoscience. So again, it becomes a contest in hearings where you set up your expert to show that there is really no proper basis to the assumptions that we're working on.
And I would just finish with saying one of the things that the UK government has got in is being a constant battle that we do win it in terms of age assessments of the biometrics using X-rays and dental examinations and so forth. But and the Home Office will constantly try to look where it's head again and say it happens in other EU states. But our partnerships with the Royal Colleges and various professionals coming together, and coming back to your point, Sheila, around the politics of it all, we have to come from our different professions with our different skill sets together to challenge this. And if it wasn't for the Royal College getting involved heavily and the Office of the Children's Commissioner at the time they stopped to try to bring it in again in the UK, we would not have been successful.
Can I just say one positive thing about biometric testing, and that's DNA testing? Because, as I said, when I started, we used to have 5-day hearings about Saleti families, because what they were saying is, well, of course, you could be more, because of so much inter-family marriaging, that this person who you're saying is your son could well be your nephew. And at that stage, by an ordinary blood test, that was very difficult to differentiate. But now, the DNA testing has completely transformed that. So you used to have hearings where you had 5 days worth of cross-examination about whether the bed sheets were green or pink, or what colour were the curtains, and then they would interview them separately and show so many inconsistencies and said, well, they can't possibly be living in the same household. So that was one measure that was a proper science, number one, and did make an enormous difference to what were otherwise really specious refusals on the basis of the person not being truly a son of the family or children of the family.
If you'd like to discuss medical interventions, I can do that for you.
So we have to close. I'll make a few announcements. I know that Bill and Catherine will be around for a little bit afterwards, so they might agree to being nobbled for questions. But just to say, the Centre has many events coming up, so please do check the website for listings. And if you want to be kept informed, you can sign up for email alerts or Twitter. LSE has a Twitter arrangement.
For a moment. Thank you very much for coming. I'm Ted Kimbart, I'm Director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. I want to thank Jenny Cooper for being a wonderful colleague during her period as a visiting fellow at the LSE. Jenny was initially a research fellow from 1999. And she was based mainly in the law department, but did a lot of work for the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. And then in September 2012, she moved to the centre as a visiting fellow. And we liked her so much that we gave her exceptional leave to remain. So she's been here for a while, and she's also worked with the Department of International Development. And for those of you who may not know her areas of work and expertise, and there's so much to say, but I'll just... Jenny's a solicitor and specialising in child-related laws, and her areas of interest are extremely wide in international human rights law and international humanitarian law, and, of course, children's rights and the United Nations and regional human rights systems, especially in Africa and in areas related to children in situations of war and conflict. And it's characteristic of her humanity that she chooses to focus amongst the most vulnerable of people, and the most vulnerable of children. And from her work in the centre, since its inception, she's been a stellar presence. She's been a solid contributor to its advisory board, has been involved regularly in planning and putting forward a number of different ideas and projects for the centre and its events and its various research activities. She's taught for many years in various aspects of the Master's MSc in Human Rights and the Centre's Certificate Course Programme, and participated and organised numerous masterclasses for our MSc Human Rights students, as well as supporting PhD students at the LSE. And in numerous other ways, she's been she's contributed to the intellectual life of the centre, the shape of the centre and its activities. So from all the staff and the students in the centre, and in law, and in sociology, and in international development and other departments, thank you very much, Jenny, for helping us all. Thank you. And may I also take this opportunity to thank Catherine Cronin and Baljeet Zandu for coming to talk to us this evening, but also for their amazing work that they've done in the past with our master's students. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you for coming, and please do join us for a drink. I'm really worried. I'm actually a bit like involved.